Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulaby. This week, it's an Oscars edition of Culturetopia. Brad Pitt has two movies up for Best Picture, Moneyball and The Tree of Life. The baseball film got him a Best Actor nod, and Pitt says his character's idiosyncrasies are what made the role so interesting. A look at the backstage lobbying going on for golden statues. Robert Siegel talks with Variety's awards editor about the tricks of Oscar campaigning. Then actor Damien Bichir is a superstar back in Mexico, but until he got nominated for Best Supporting Actor, he was relatively unknown in the United States. In A Better Life, he plays an undocumented worker scraping by as a gardener in Los Angeles. But first,
when it comes to books, people are increasingly leaving the physical world behind. Sales of actual paper books dropped last year, while e-book sales more than doubled. And something similar is happening with movies and music. Think about it. When was the last time you bought a polycarbonate plastic disc from your favorite band? All of this has critic Bob Mondello thinking about what our lives will look like when the things we love aren't visible anymore.
When Hollywood imagines the future, from Star Trek to Avatar, it tends to picture living spaces as sterile and characterless, without cultural clues to the person living there. No record library, no Hemingway on bookshelves, often no bookshelves. And here we are catching up to that vision, less and less real-world clutter as we stream everything on the web.
Welcome to the desert of the real.
In The Matrix, people interact in a reassuringly cluttered but virtual reality. Actual reality is barren, nothing physical to establish that one person is different from another. It is a horror story in which humanity has abandoned all of what makes us human. This fear of losing ourselves as we lose our stuff, a product of bad experiences with technology? Well, from science fiction, you'd sure think so. Broadcast TV was brand new when the novel Fahrenheit 451 imagined a world that outlawed books. Early space travel inspired the computer HAL and his sterile domain in 2001, A Space Odyssey. But the computer age didn't invent this. British author E.M. Forster had similar thoughts more than a century ago. In 1909, right after writing A Room with a View, he penned a story about a cave without a view. The Machine Stops, written pre-radio, almost pre-technology, in an age of gaslight and pianos in the parlor.
A small room, hexagonal in shape like the cell of a bee. It is lighted neither by window nor by lamp, yet it is filled with a soft radiance. There are no musical instruments, and yet this room is throbbing with melodious sounds. An armchair is in the center, by its side a reading desk. That is all the furniture. And in the armchair sits a woman, Vashti, with a face as white as a fungus. It is to her that the little room belongs.
There are reasons for picturing sterile environments in stories about the future. Space travel requires eliminating things that'll float around in zero gravity. Clean lines feel modern because they contrast with the accumulated mess of everyday existence. But isn't our mess what defines us as individuals? Forster thought so and figured we'd grow isolated without it. So a century before computer geeks, he imagined Skype and the iPad.
The round plate that she held in her hands began to glow. A faint blue light shot across it, darkening to purple. And presently she could see the image of her son, who lived on the other side of the Earth, and he could see her.
Kuno, what is it, dearest boy? I want to see you not through the machine, said Kuno. I see something like you in this plate, but I do not see you. I want you to pay me a visit, so that we can meet face to face.
Have a little face time? The folks at Apple would recognize that. Imagine Forster's horror if he could see people in headphones avoiding eye contact on the street. These days we say technology's the culprit, but Forster was writing decades before TV created couch potatoes, and his character Vashti doesn't want to leave her little hexagonal cave. Why would she?
For a moment, Vashti felt lonely. Then the sight of her room, studded with electric buttons, revived her. Buttons to call for food, for music, the button that produced literature. And there were, of course, the buttons by which she communicated with her friends. The clumsy system of public gatherings had been long since abandoned.
Abandoned? For chat rooms, online dating, we're almost there. Whole relationships can be virtual until you're in the home of a new acquaintance, at which point, what do? Scan the bookshelves, Faulkner or Tom Clancy. And on the stereo, Sinatra or the Sex Pistols? A friend told me the other day that she no longer has CDs. All her music is on her iPod. She still has books, but she's buying fewer. Her entertainment center overflows Disney, but when her family outgrows those DVDs, so will her living room. Her kids will mature in a world without hard copies of things their mom's generation used to define living spaces and tell people who they are. Should we fret over what's disappearing? Cool album covers? Toy soldiers? Won't the next generation be isolated without them? Like Vashti, staring at screens?
The room, though it contained nothing, was in touch with all that she cared for in the world.
The title of E.M. Forster's story, remember, is The Machine Stops. It's about over-reliance on devices. But as in most dystopias, technology and the chill of the modern are stand-ins. The anxiety is age-old, given voice by artists since people first gathered in caves. It's a fear of being alone. Once you've felt the comfort of society, you worry about losing it. So to remind yourself and others of how you're all connected, you gather things around, and you cling to them not so you won't lose them or lose what makes you you, but so you won't lose the connections they represent. The fear is of emptiness, but of emptiness inside us, not empty rooms. I'm Bob Mundell.
When the Academy Awards are given out this month, Brad Pitt will have a shot at two for his work on Moneyball. He's nominated for Best Actor as the star of the film based on the true story of the general manager of baseball's Oakland A's. The film won praise for finding drama without all that many Hollywood tricks. It's the story of a guy who does not play baseball anymore but remakes the game through statistical analysis. Brad Pitt could also get an Oscar for Best Picture because he's listed as a producer.
Producer means you get to, it's a further extension, first of all, of acting, but you get to start from the inception of an idea of what a film's going to be. So you get to start with story in its most nascent form, and that's what I most appreciate. And something that's not talked about enough is tone, deciding on the tone of a film.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these pieces and moving parts that you put together is all in support of that tone.
Moneyball had many pieces and moving parts. Before audiences could see the story of a baseball executive assembling the right pitchers, catchers, and fielders, somebody had to assemble a director, cast, and crew. It took Pitt several years and a lot of frustration to make that happen. Was there something that obsessed you about this story?
Yeah, I was obsessed with the story of this obsessive person who wanted to find a level playing field. He was a guy who had been devalued by the sport as a player and now was working as a GM for a small market team. And there's such a gulf in what these teams have to spend on talent. Therefore, they can never play equally. They can never have a true competition.
I'd like to play a little clip, if I can, from Moneyball. This is a scene early in the movie in which your character, Billy Beane, is meeting with the team owner and basically begging for more money, a bigger payroll, to make a better team for next season.
I need more money.
We don't have any
I can't
more money,
compete Billy. Against a $120 million payroll with $38 million.
But we're not going to compete with these teams that have big budgets.
I'm not asking you for tens of $20, $30 million. I'm just asking for a little bit of help. Just get me a little bit closer, and I will get you that championship team. I mean, this is why I'm here. This is why you hired me. And I got to ask you, what are we doing here?
Billy, you know,
it's not to win a championship.
I want to ask about the expression on your face in roles like that. People who've seen the movie may note it. That in those moments of frustration or desperation even, your character often gets a little smile, a little smirk on his face. Are you consciously expressing something? Is that just Brad Pitt? I mean, it seems like several emotions are on his face all at the same time. It's rather affecting.
I'm not aware of that, actually. what I like about that scene is he knows he's losing the argument, and he's getting more and more frustrated and therefore more and more pushy and trying, you know, every Hail Mary he can to get in there and reason, to the point where he almost insults his boss. And he's got no other cards to play. Maybe that's the smirk. It's a no-win situation.
Part of his character, part of his charm, is that he just clearly doesn't have a well-rounded life. He's obsessed with work. He's divorced. He tries to stay in touch with his daughter. But this is a guy who is consumed with work.
Well-rounded is not necessarily my concern. I like him for the fact that he, you know, his idiosyncrasies, that he can't watch the games without getting too emotional, that he's often has food down his shirt. He's tends to break a few chairs now and then. I mean, these things make him human. These things make him interesting to me.
It occurs to me that, as a movie viewer, that it was quite lucky for you that your character doesn't watch the game, because if he did, I mean, he's the general manager. He'd just be sitting there helpless. But instead, your character can sprawl out in the weight room. He can get in a truck and drive around. He can turn the radio on. He can turn it off for the key pitch. There are things for you to do as an actor you couldn't do in the stands.
Yes, that is true.
When you do a film that is based on reality, as Moneyball is, there must be a point at which you have to let go of your best approximation of the reality and let it become its own reality.
Films are like that. They're in this dynamic flux every day, and the day you shoot that day informs the day after what you're going to shoot next. In the scout scene, for example, putting that together, people talking on each other, trying to discover the rhythm of it, and maybe one of the scouts has another way to say it that's more inside baseball.
Let's describe for people that scene who haven't seen the movie. You're sitting around a table with a bunch of baseball scouts and other veterans of the team. They are middle-aged or well beyond middle-aged. Your character in his mid-40s is probably about the youngest guy at the table, and it's your character's instinct against everybody else's experience.
Okay, here's who we want. David Justice.
Oh, no.
Really not a good idea, Billy.
Old man Justice? Why is that?
Steinbrenner's so pissed at his decline that he's willing to eat a big chunk of his contract just to get rid of him.
Anybody? Exactly.
10 years ago, David Justice, big name. Been a lot of big games. He's going to really help our season tickets early in the year, but we get in the dog days in July and August. He's lucky if he's going to hit his weight.
So these are real baseball scouts. And the things that they're coming up to say, were they things that they had actually said at some point in their life, like, that guy's going to be a great player, he's got a good strong jaw?
Yeah. We had a work session where about 30 scouts came in, and we're all riffing. And after it, Bennett Miller said, look at these faces, and this is what we got to do. We got to get these guys in the scene. We had a couple of the best writers in town, but they're not inside baseball, and these guys could lend an authenticity that's even beyond what we had on the page.
So you brought them in for research, and then they became part of the film.
That's right.
When you're Brad Pitt, and you're also listed as a producer on the film, is the director? Are you working for the director, Bennett Miller, or is he working for you?
No, always working for the director. I just take credit for being smart enough to find a guy as smart as Bennett to tell the story.
Didn't Bennett Miller join this production in midstream?
Yes, there were several starts and stops, and he was the third director to pick this thing up. First was David Frankel, and then Steven Soderbergh, and then Bennett came in.
What happened?
Well, we came up to the last minute. We were supposed to be filming days before, and when the studio had seen the script, they didn't like the price. They had no problem with the story, but at that price, they could not justify it. And we could not bring it down to a price that both sides would be happy with, so we had to start over.
Oh, now, wait a minute. Were you having the same kind of experience that Billy Bean was having trying to put together a baseball team for not quite as much money as Avatar, say?
A little bit, yes. A little bit. I dare make those comparisons, but we often said the making of would be as interesting, if not more interesting, than the film.
Well, Brad Pitt, thanks very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You know it's Oscar campaign season when Brad Pitt and George Clooney and Meryl Streep all appear on NPR programs some weeks after their Oscar-nominated movies were released. Some films that haven't been in theaters for months suddenly reappear, with primetime trailers touting their nominations. And in Los Angeles and New York, there's no end to the free screenings for Academy members, rare FaceTime with the stars and filmmakers, and the gaudy full-page ads in The Times, both of them, and the trade magazines. Call it the Oscar Industrial Complex. Joining us now is Christy Gross, the awards editor for Variety, to talk about this. And first of all, Christy, when do the polls close and who has the vote here?
The polls close next Tuesday, February 21st, and ballots need to be completed and in the hands of the Academy's accounting firm, PricewaterhouseCoopers, by 5 p.m. that day. But the people who vote on the Academy Awards, it's about a group of a little bit less than 6,000 entertainment professionals. It's an invitation-only group of people. They're all people who work now or have worked in the business across all different disciplines, whether it's sound mixing, acting, directing, screenwriting, those types of disciplines.
And I take it that the very fact that Variety has a job like yours, being the awards editor, proves that this is an institution. This is a big deal.
Yeah, it is a big deal. And I think that the Academy goes out of its way every year to acknowledge and accept the fact that campaigning is going to go on, but to make sure that it happens in a way that maintains the integrity of the award. That's why every year you see rule changes and tweaking of what you can and can't do throughout the season to promote your film to Academy members.
This time last year, Best Supporting Actress nominee Melissa Leo caused a stir by taking out her own ads in the Hollywood trade magazines, one of her in a faux fur coat standing beside a swimming pool. The ads were panned, but she won. Is it assumed that she might have turned some votes with that?
You know, it's funny because there are examples of that nearly every year since the Academy Awards began. I mean, Mary Pickford famously had Academy members to pick fair her lovely house in Bel Air for tea to convince them that they should vote for her for Best Actress for Coquette. So it's kind of funny, but I think that it just depends. You can't say for certain that kind of thing really changes people's minds. I mean, there is sort of an adage about how you can make people see movies, but you can't make them like them, and you can't make them vote for them.
I understand, though, that the Academy did some campaign reform this year. The rules are a little bit different?
They are a little bit different. And, for instance, one of the other things that happened last year was Julia Roberts hosted a private screening for Beautiful, the Javier Bardem foreign language film. And the film at that time hadn't really gotten a lot of momentum going in the award circuit. And, you know, she was in the press saying that she was so enthusiastic about this performance. And he ultimately ended up getting an Academy Award nomination for the performance. So even though what she was doing at the time, there was nothing at all that was against the rules in mm-hmm. what she was doing. And it was really some, you know, out of love for her co-star's performance that she did the screening. But it also led to the Academy saying that no Academy members can host a screening and they can't endorse a performance in order to sway voters, basically.
I gather Harvey Weinstein is considered the father of the modern Oscar campaign. Fair enough?
I think that's definitely a fair assessment, yes.
What are his great successes?
Well, I mean, just look at last year with The King's Speech. You know, I think that he knows that it's not done until the ballots are in PricewaterhouseCoopers' hands. And for that reason, he's able to ignore the criticism. He's able to come up with creative ways to promote his films. He's able to stay on message throughout any leg of a campaign. And last year with King's Speech, that film, it hadn't swept all the precursor awards the way that The Social Network had. So, you know, even though it didn't get all those awards, he was able to keep it top of mind for voters and take it to a Best Picture win.
Well, Christy Gross, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Christy Gross is the awards editor for Variety.
The Academy Award for Best Actor has one surprise nominee this year, Damien Bichir. He is a superstar in his home country, Mexico, but relatively unknown in the U.S., though he is seen on the TV show Weeds. In his Oscar-nominated role in A Better Life, the actor plays Carlos Galindo, an undocumented worker scraping by as a gardener in Los Angeles. Carlos is a single father who lives in fear of being deported and of losing his son to gang life, even as he always strives to do better.
I'm going to make something out of this business. I'm going to make it grow into something big. so we can move out of here and get you in a better school. And I'm not gonna work Sundays no more. We can do things. Spend time together.
As a young man, Damien Bichir was already successful in Mexico when he decided to try launching an acting career in America.
I grew up in the theater in Mexico, and I was doing already, you know, Shakespeare, Strindberg, O'Neill in the National Theater Company in Mexico. But there was a point where I wanted to give my actor other kinds of experiences. And ever since I saw Taxi Driver, I always wanted to drive a cab in New York. And I end up working at this Mexican restaurant, learning how to make guacamoles. And
something I gather you didn't really have to do back in Mexico.
I never did that in Mexico, and I learned how to do that in New York. But I was paying my dues as an actor here because I was trying to learn English, and I of course wanted to pursue a career over here. And it was really, really hard because the competition over here is brutal.
I mean, generally speaking, and then in your case, you would have also been speaking not great English at the time.
Oh, well, no, I didn't do any. I mean, I didn't know any English. All I knew was the pencil is red and the window is open and listen up, class, good morning and good afternoon, and that's that. And I thought I knew enough to defend myself. And then when I got to New York, it was like Chinese for me because I just couldn't understand anything. But I'm really, really stubborn. So I kept trying, and then I moved back to Mexico and then back to Los Angeles. I've been, you know, coming back and forth for many years, but never quit.
Let's talk about Carlos Galindo. What did you learn that you actually didn't know from the very people who do these jobs, the day laborers here in Los Angeles?
I think what happened is that I confirmed what I knew, that all this community of human beings are hardworking people with pride and dignity. But the one thing that I didn't know, it was that every time you go up on a palm tree, there's a real risk that you can lose your life.
And you discovered that by?
I discovered that the hard way. There's this scene on the film, and Carlos Galindo has to go up and trim the palm leaves, the palms. So Chris Weitz asked me.
Chris Weitz, the director.
Chris Weitz, the director, yeah. He asked me, how do you feel about going up the tree? And I remember the day we actually tried for the first time. A real gardener did it first, and he crossed himself. He made the sign of the cross, and so we understood it was a serious deal. And then Chris Weitz went up first. And when your director does the stunts before you, you have to do it, pretty much.
Well, we have a clip of that scene where your character Carlos is going up the palm tree. It's really, really high. And the boss is down below with the homeowner.
Please tell him to be careful.
Don't worry, Mrs. Donnelly. He does this all the time. He's a professional. This is the way we do it in Mexico. It's safe. Believe me.
And that's you, Carlos, speaking from above down to the boss below. What are you saying?
I'm saying, yeah, really? If it's so safe, why don't you climb up, you fatty?
It would be a moment where Carlos actually speaks out. Of course, he's speaking in Spanish because, as he says of himself in the film, I will stay quiet, I will keep my head down, and I will try to stay invisible in his real life.
That's right. And that's pretty much the way 11 million undocumented workers live in this country. They're not fully free. And that's a really weird feeling. It's a terrible feeling.
What, though, for you as an actor, was the challenge of playing a character who doesn't want to be seen?
Exactly that. Because I'm also, you know, like an outgoing kind of person. And to keep it quiet, to keep it down, was the real challenge. Of course, there's the physical part of it. We gain 20 pounds for the character because Chris and I wanted Carlos Galindo to look heavier and to have this really wonderful tummy and una panza sabrosa, because my paisanos, they begin working at 7 a.m. and they don't have time to take care of a proper diet.
When you say paisanos, meaning?
Paisano is your fellow countryman. Hmm. And that's how we call each other, you know, in a nice kind of familiar way.
There was a moment, I gather, where you were actually taken on the street by other gardeners to be actually working as a gardener. One of these workers was overheard having spotted you in character saying, something like, gosh.
Exactly. Things aren't working in Mexico. I bought this beat-up truck in a red light in the streets of Los Angeles. I just talked to one of my paisanos there. Hey, paisanos, do you sell your truck? I said, no, man, I work with it. What do you mean? I said, oh, please, man, sell it to me. I need it. So we closed the deal that night. And so that's what I drove for 3-4 months. And everything changes when you drive a beat-up truck in Los Angeles. And people are rude. And people assume you're a loser. And even my paisanos, when they saw me in that truck, they said something about, oh, man, acting's not doing really well lately. I said, no, paisanos, yeah, well, I'll tell you the story later.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you so very much.
And thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Damien Bichir, he's nominated for an Oscar for Best Actor in the film A Better Life.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. Culturetopia is produced by Mike Katziff and executive produced by Sarah Saracen. I am Neda Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.